Adventures of a Bookonaut podcast featuring views and interviews on genre fiction in the Australasian region. I'm your host, Sean Wright, and welcome to episode 1. This episode features Luke Preston, author of Dark City Blue, Jolyn Alexandra, Singaporean crime writer, and academic and author of The Secret Feminist Cabal, Dr. Helen Merrick. Hello, you're listening to Sean from Adventures of a Bookonaut, and in this segment I'm interviewing debut novelist Luke Preston. Welcome to the podcast, Luke.
Thanks for having me, man.
First question. You've just released your first novel, Dark City Blue, through the digital first imprint Momentum, the offspring of Pam McMillan, the digital offspring. How did this come about, and how do you feel about being a digital first author?
I love being a digital first author. I pretty much only read digitally anyway, either it's on the iPad or the Kindle or the iPhone. I like the idea of trying something new, something different, and the fact that you can get a book instantly is really appealing to me, and I can take it anywhere. I like the idea that people can read my book no matter where they are, through their different devices syncing together, or just the fact that if you're you don't need to lug that big 400-page thing around anymore. You can just take one device and it's got whatever you want to read on it, and it can be read anywhere. The way the book ended up at Momentum was pretty standard, really. My agent met with Joel. She liked what they were doing. She thought it would be a good match, and she sent the book in. And so it was a pretty standard kind of, I guess, way of doing it.
Okay. And in terms of the sort of services they offer, I don't want it to turn into an ad for Momentum, but some of our listeners out there would possibly be interested. They handled all the cover art and the editing side of things, just like a normal publisher would?
Absolutely everything, yeah. Editorial, marketing, yeah, cover, blurb, everything like that.
Yeah, I must admit that I came across your book through social media, through a tweet, I think, from... It might have been Trent Jamison, the Brisbane author Trent Jamison, and had picked up on what he was saying about the book. And, yeah, you're right, it was quite simply, it's whatever price it was, I can't remember, it was very cheap. Two clicks and I had it and I was reading it, and halfway through it by the time I sort of mentioned it anywhere else. So, yeah, it's very smooth, very, very, very easy to get into. We'll get into your book in a little second. But, yeah, no, I just wanted to say it was... very streamlined going through Momentum.
Yeah, a big problem, you've probably experienced it in the past as well, that when you want a book, you go to 3 or 4 bookshops and they may not have it, or they may have it, but generally they don't, because bookshops can only hold a certain amount of titles. And if you want that book, you have to go online and you have to wait 3 or 4 weeks or whatever it could be. This way, I like, if I hear a book, and I've done this so often, and I've probably bought a lot more books since I've been reading digitally than I did previously, because of the ease of being able to do so. I hear in an interview somebody talk about a title, and I go, that sounds interesting, and 60 seconds later I have that book.
I tend to agree. Whether or not I'm actually reading more or just buying more probably doesn't matter for authors. I remember talking to Joe Abercrombie or listening to him at a conference, and he said, you don't have to read my books, you just have to buy them. So... All right, then we'll move on to the next question. The reading public has some misconceptions when it comes to being a novelist, the pay grade being one of them. What misconception or aspiration was dashed when you encountered the reality of being a published novelist?
I think the biggest kind of misconception I had was that editors and publishers want to change your work. I come from a background in film where everybody wants to change your work. From, you know, ridiculous things to, like, I don't like the colour blue, can we change it, to the whole third act doesn't work. So I went into the process open like that, thinking that the rewrite's going to be huge. But going through the editing process, it was always about what works for the author. And I thought that was really cool and something I hadn't really experienced before. The fact that everybody involved is there to make the best book possible. And both... Mark and Joel, and also my editor, Gareth, all understood what the book was about, and every editorial decision was made to service the book rather than any other kind of need. And that's what I really enjoyed. I thought that was really... it was a different and new experience for me. And you hear these horror stories about authors talking about how somebody ruined their, some editor had all these ideas to ruin their book. Well, I think it's probably just, thinking about it now, just writers complaining or wanting their words not to change, or possibly even, because it's a lot of work editing, possibly even not wanting to edit anything more. Because getting a book to a certain stage is hard. Getting it even better is even harder. So for me, I was expecting a huge, huge rewrite, and the editing process was pretty, pretty cool and cruisy, which kind of was a surprise to me.
Okay, that's an interesting response. Yeah, I was just trying to think there of when you were mentioning re-editing the work, it's almost as if the writing of the first four drafts, whatever it takes to get it to presenting it to a publisher, is the easy part. When you've got to go back and go over each and every line, that's when, I mean, personally in my own writing, that's when I find I get really close to the work and I have no idea whether the tone or whether everything's making sort of sense in conjunction with one another. That does really sound like a great response from them. So we're talking them up a bit on this podcast. I better hit them up for some money. I checked out the book trailer for Dark City Blue, and I was thinking that some Australian listeners or viewers might notice some familiar faces. How did you go about organising the trailer? And was it important that it was live action as opposed to just voiceover and images?
I hate voiceover with a passion. That is it's a really lazy way of telling story, especially on cinema. And regardless of whether the trailer is, obviously it lives online, so it's viewed online, it's still a visual medium. And lazy voiceover, or even just reading chunks of the book out, is not. It's a different medium. Yeah, I don't think it really translates. So when I thought about the idea of doing a book trailer, I hunted the internet for awesome book trailers, and there were some really killer ones out there. But the ones that really worked had a simple, clear, one proposition that they were trying to tell you about their book, and they were also cinematic. So those are the two things that I kind of wanted to achieve with the trailer, and also a short time frame, because I don't know how many book trailers I've clicked on to watch, and it's like 4 minutes. And it's like, man, that's not a trailer. That's like a short film. so that was the requirements I had, and I was quite lucky that I'd probably done 40 or 50 or 60 short films. I don't even know how many. And I was lucky to get a really good crew and an awesome director to direct it. And when the director was Jason Christo, and when he came on board, everything just went up another level. That's why it looks so slick. If it was me directing it, I don't know much of a director, and it wouldn't have looked great. But Jace really made it look cool. And basically, we were in pre-production for 2 weeks, and we shot for, I don't know, 6 or 7 hours, if that. And a week after that, we had what you saw in the can, sound mixed and colour graded and everything like that.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think it's about 51 seconds, so... Yeah. 7 hours plus post-production into 51 seconds. That's an interesting insight into the back end of trailer production.
But if we were doing if we're going to do that, because it's obviously in one location and it's done for a financial reason, but if we're shooting a feature film, we'll shoot that for 2 days. But you still, even though it runs for 50 seconds, we still needed to set that location up to look like the way it did, even if it ran for 50 seconds or ran for a 10-minute action scene. So it was you still need the same set and costume and everything. It's just the running length that changes. But yeah, there's a lot of work for 50 seconds.
So we're talking a bit about film here, and you've mentioned you've done a fair few short films. You're also undertaking a master's of screenwriting, and I wanted to ask you how film study and script writing may have influenced this novel or the writing of this novel?
I think immensely. There's a kind of a rule that I work for in film, in any story. The principles of story are the same regardless, film or novel or song. You need to engage the audience emotionally and intellectually. But the biggest thing I think that I've taken from screenwriting to novel writing is don't waste words. Because in screenwriting, words cost money. And no matter which way you factor it, could be $1,000 a page or $10,000 a page, it costs money to write. So I've taken that economy into novel writing, I think, and just told the most amount of story that I can in the few amount of words. I write big, like I think probably 20,000 words all up was cut out of Dark City Blue from the original draft, and that's just because you take out words you don't need constantly, and that's probably the biggest editing skill I have. Apart from that, I don't really have much editing skills besides taking words out that I don't need. And there is also another principle which I always use in both, and that is if a scene doesn't push the story forward or it doesn't reveal anything new about character, it has to go. And I think a lot of novels, you've got the flexibility to go off on tangents and explore new things and come back. But it's just something I just don't do because I'm used to telling a story in a kind of a single-minded kind of way.
Yeah, and I tend to think that, well, I'm just thinking to when I was reading the book, it moves along at a fairly cracking pace. Not so much that you're breathless as a reader, if that makes any sense. But yeah, like you say, it there's nothing unnecessary in there, and that works for me as a reader. And I can think of possibly a couple of other genre writers outside of sort of crime thriller writing that do that. A couple of fantasy authors are quite economical in their writing as well. But it's something that's not, that I don't come across unless I'm really reading crime or thriller novels. So, that's interesting to note that's where you're coming from there. You might be able to put this in your Twitter tips for writing. No longer are novelists able to be cranky hermit-like recluses. This is the digital age, and being connected is all the rage. What's your personal approach to social media for those who, unlike me, don't follow you on Twitter?
I love Twitter, and I kind of tolerate Facebook. I think Facebook has just got too much homework involved. But the idea of Twitter, I think, is brilliant for writers. You can share information, which is you can create a community of writers from all around the world, and it's great. And you can, if it's an article that you like or some insight that you found out, you can share that with people. And the fact that it's a writing medium is perfect for writers. My approach to Twitter is it's got to be one of three things. It's got to be either funny, you tell a joke. It's either got to be a writing tip, something that other people can learn from, or maybe apply to their own work. And the third aspect of that is still promotional. It's sell the book, pretty much. And there's different ways around doing that, but they're the three things that I stick to. If it's just me going to the shop to buy milk, you're not going to hear about that. So it's going to be one of those three things. I really, with the blog that I keep, it's all writing only. And so it's each post is and will be a tip on something that people can apply to their own work. I want people to read it, enjoy reading it, but also hopefully take something away that they can apply to their own writing that may help. I'm not a big fan of hoarding ideas or tips. I think give ideas away to people if they can apply it to their own work. That's great, you've helped someone, that's awesome. So it's not like, I think social media is great for sharing information pretty much. And It's always like the trailer's there now, and it's not just words anymore, it's all multimedia. Like you can do music, you can do whatever. And I think it's such a cool thing just to share info.
Changing tack a bit here, moving away from social media. I was listening to a panel of writers at Supernova recently, and the group seemed to be split roughly down the middle between those who wanted to write from a young age as compared to those who took it up on a whim. And I was just wondering, which are you? What did you, or why did you want to get into the writing game?
For me, and it's different for everybody, but for me there was no choice. I think writing kind of chose me, and that's all I've ever done. Since I was young, I was writing and playing music as well, which I think music's quite a storytelling kind of thing. And ever since high school, I was always writing. And then since I got out of high school, it was film. And last few years, I guess longer form stories such as novels and so on. But either you write or you don't. The guys that kind of do it on a whim were probably always writers, but they didn't realize that themselves, I think, because it's not something that you can really wake up one day and decide, I'm going to be a writer. I feel bad when I don't write. Like, writing keeps me sane pretty much. So it's it's not really a choice anymore. It's something I have to do. It's kind of like if you had a knee injury and you had to do rehab. It's that kind of thing. So I'll write on the train, I'll write anywhere. No matter what I'm doing, I'll always have to write from stage through the day. And 3 days without writing, I'm bored. I literally am wandering around the house annoying everybody. So I have to do it. And if I can't, and it's always been like that since I was young. I always had to write.
Crime fiction and crime television seem to be on fire at the moment. We've just had some really good Jack Irish telemovies and Underbelly churned out a number of spin-offs. And I was wondering what attracted you to the genre, and if you could name 3 works off the top of your head that have influenced you, what would they be?
What I like about crime, I think, is that it merges 2 things together that I'm interested in. I'm interested in fast-paced action stories, and you can do that within crime, but I'm also interested in moral ambiguities and issues of the day and those kinds of community things, and community could be the suburb, the state, the country, the world, that you can execute those ideas through crime. And you always could. Crime stories have always been a reflection of society, more so than any other genre. But when it comes to the ones that kind of influenced me most, I guess there's probably 3 things that three distinct things that have influenced me in crime writing, and that would be James Ellroy's writing. I think it's so fast-paced, and although his books are huge, they're full of story. They're not full of architecture and writing about furniture and descriptions of things. It's all story. And what I learned from that is that how little you need on the page to convey an idea to a reader. Another huge influence to me was Johnny Cash. His songs are always stories, and it was that mix of, I guess, heart and roughness, where you'll write a love story and then you'll write a murder ballad. And it's that kind of storytelling which for me it's kind of Johnny Cash's stuff is almost early hip-hop. And also I think Peter Corris was a big influence on my writing, because it taught me to, you can tell any story you want with an Australian angle. Like Peter Corris's Cliff Hardy series was the first Australian PI. And it works brilliantly. And he's still writing these books. These books come out every 6 weeks almost. It was, I guess, a combination of all those three that Peter Corris could teach me to tell any story I want in my own voice.
Yeah.
Johnny Cash was the mix of violence and love. And James Ellroy was storytelling, where you can tell a genre and make it mean something.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking of your character, Tom Bishop, and I was thinking in my head that sort of, and I mentioned it in the review I did of your book, of to use an American actor, I thought Bruce Willis plays the role very well, that sort of hard character, hard-hitting character with ultimately a heart of gold. And that ties in well with what you've just said there about violence and love and Johnny Cash. And talking about Dark City Blue, I felt that you left the end of the book a little open-ended. I'm just wondering if we're going to get another Tom Bishop novel, or do we have to put a gun to your head?
No, there's one on the way. It's actually about 30,000 words into it now. And it's bigger in scope than the first one, and bigger in story, and moves twice as fast, I think. It's it takes place, I think, that final moment in Dark City Blue. The second book picks up right after that.
Well, that's tantalising out there for the readers that have picked it up. And I'm just thinking about, because this podcast will be available internationally, I'm just wondering, with Dark City Blue, Momentum have that out in all outlets, don't they? Kobo, Amazon, and it's pretty much available DRM free worldwide.
Yeah, you can pick it up anywhere, anywhere at any time from most of the, all of the kind of digital retailers. It's pretty easy to get your hands on a copy of that.
Yeah, no, I was going to say to the listeners listening, I've read the book, absolutely loved it. I'm not a big crime genre fan, but I do occasionally get them for review. But this was a book recommended to me by a friend, and it hit all the buttons for me. So it was fast-paced, good story, and I just wanted to thank you for coming on the podcast, Luke. Thanks for the opportunity to interview you, and good luck with the next book.
Thank you very much.
This is Kirsten McDermott.
And Ian Mond.
From The Writer and The Critic.
And you're listening to... Ow!
Do it properly.
And you're listening to The Adventures of a Bookonaut Podcast.
That wasn't so bad, was it?
Can you put the pointy stick down now?
Hello, you're listening to Sean from Adventures of a Bookonaut, and I'm interviewing Singaporean author Jolyn Alexander. How are you?
Hello.
Well, welcome to the podcast. Hi. I'm just wondering, you've literally just stepped off the plane from Singapore. How are you finding Australia so far?
Not as hot as I thought it would be. I was told that this is the month where all the heat waves and the high temperatures would come, but actually it's quite nice. It's quite nice. It's very much like what we are experiencing in Singapore at the moment. Yeah.
Okay. No, thankfully it's not 40 degrees every day. So.
Yeah.
All right, so Singapore is a fair distance from Australia. Why out of all of Australia did you pick Adelaide?
Because of the South Australian Writers' Centre, frankly speaking.
Because we're that good here in South Australia.
Yeah, and also because I thought the other cities can be a bit too big, I find. I know that Melbourne has become the UNESCO City of Literature, so that's going to be where everybody is. I'm not very sure if somebody who is interested but not there yet is going to get what he or she may come for. So I thought Adelaide would be a good place to kind of start because of all this emerging events and the centre and all the writers coming up. Yeah.
Okay, no, that's that sounds like a good idea, actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're actually recording in the Writers' Centre at the moment, a beautiful space. Encourage other writers that are listening to the podcast, if you're in South Australia, to come on down and perhaps join up. But one of my reasons for wanting to interview, aside from the fact that you're actually in my state and I only have to travel 2 hours to see you, is that I feel that Singaporean writers or Southeast Asian writers in general have a hard time being heard outside of Singapore, and I'm talking genre fiction in particular. I was just wondering, is that a misconception on my part, or is that the case?
I think it's a problem with most countries that are not under the radar of the Big Six. Singapore has writers, Singapore has publishers. The problem is the marketing of these titles. We do have quite a few titles, but they rarely go out of the local scene, mostly because there is publishers may find very little return or return on investment if they were to, like, you know, ship it overseas, because, you know, of all the back costs and everything, and also because it all also comes down to marketing itself. Apart from people like Catherine Lim or Weena Poon or Alvin Pang, all of whom have been published in the UK, those who have been locally published tend to have a bit of difficulty. I think mostly because we don't have that whole basis of promoting Singaporean writers in the first place. Most countries I know have you know, all these big names because they have things like agencies and sub-agents, and the publishers pump in a lot of funds or resources just to push these names out, the content and everything. So I guess that's the missing link for Singaporean writers. It's growing though. We have books, actually, our own independent bookstore, doing a lot of promotional work for especially emerging writers and local writers itself. Yeah.
Yeah, and even I've heard of books, actually, so in that sense it's working. So,
yeah.
Yeah. If you could, and this may not make sense now that you've covered that last question, but what do you think is the number one misconception about Singaporean writers by Western, and I mean Australia, US, UK, readers or writers? What have you come across in your travels or in your online discussions that you think, oh, what are the misconceptions, if any?
I think there are two main ones, actually. The first one, we write in English. Most of us write in English. We do write in like our other languages, like there's Mandarin, there's Malay, there's Tamil. But generally speaking, we write in English. This came about because one of our friends, Weena Poon, she's actually based in US. And when she first started pushing her stories, people were actually asking if she needed a translator because she was Singaporean. So I think that's the first misconception. Most of us do write in English, even though some of us write in other languages as well. The second one is that Singaporean writers do write a good variety of content. It's not just about talking about Singaporean culture or talking about what makes people Singaporean. You also have a whole range of people thinking about alternate Singapore. For example, one of the latest anthologies out by Books Actually, Smith Paper Press, The Iron Curtain, talks about alternative Singapore in different types of genre. And as I was reading through the pieces, it kind of struck me that, you know, it's not just about symbols, it's not just about where you're from, it's also about writing what you feel like writing. And I guess that's one thing that most writers feel comfortable with. You know, you feel comfortable writing about what you want, not what people expect you to write. So that's the other misconception, I guess.
So you're a crime and speculative fiction writer. Those are your areas that you like to write about?
Yeah, my interest is actually in crime and speculative fiction. I think it's the staple diet of James Bond and Indiana Jones when I was younger that came to me. At the moment, now my own work in progress circles around organized crime, which I think has been very glamorized by a lot of people who are not in the whole thick of things. People have watched things like movies from Hong Kong or heard stories, you will find that organized crime actually has a very different kind of take, especially in Singapore, where there's talk about this gang and that gang and brotherhood and areas. And now as it progresses, they have things like business fronts for their activities. And I guess that's very interesting, because what we do see a lot of times is a lot of very violent, down-your-throat kind of gangsterism that people kind of get sick of after a while. So that's, I find that's one thing that's very interesting about crime, because it's not just about the whole black and white view of things, but it's also about, I was telling this to my friend after watching Criminal Minds, it doesn't just talk about the criminality of people behind bars, but it also talks about how guilty, how guilt affects those who are outside of things like prison and jail, because, you know, you can't deny that sometimes society itself plays a part in doing all these things to other people.
Okay, yeah. So in that sense, talking about somebody gets released from prison and they go back to the same sort of community that they came from, and that community is not helpful in
something like that, or people just
getting better,
or people coming out of jail and not wanting anything to do with the community, that kind of community, and they come looking for them again, something like that.
Okay, what do you think's the biggest hurdle to getting noticed as a genre writer, both within Singapore and outside?
I think the biggest hurdle is getting people to try something new. From what we have experienced, people are very comfortable with familiar names, and when they see someone not, they see someone new, it's for them it becomes very it becomes a bit of a, I wouldn't say doubt, but they get a little bit apprehensive, even though you have people or the publishers going like, you know, this book is very good, you can get it, or the content has this kind of interesting plot and twist. And I guess it's getting through that first hurdle, because especially for new writers, they don't see your name much, they don't know if it's worth spending money, and books are not exactly the cheapest thing. So that's probably the biggest hurdle.
It's just recognition.
It's just recognition itself, yeah.
And that's from the publisher as well as the reader?
I think it's it depends. Publishers, it depends on which publishers you go to. Some of them are very supportive. Some of them I'm not trying to say that they're not supportive, but sometimes they also have to think about things like the business economics and everything else. So it's understandable, but I think especially for people who can write well and are new and emerging, a bit more support would actually do them a bit of good.
No worries. Now, I read in your online profile that you do martial arts.
Not really, actually.
Not really, no?
Not really. Interest, yes. Not really. I don't go to a school.
Okay, no, fair enough. I only ask because I've got a martial arts background, so I was interested. Because whenever I'm reading martial arts, mm-hmm. or books that have martial arts in them, so yeah, a little bit of crime, but usually my thriller stuff, some American mm-hmm. thriller writers like Barry Eisler, very realistic in their depiction of mm-hmm. fighting and what happens and that sort of thing. And I was just wondering, do you have any pet dislikes or pet hates when you see martial arts depicted in fiction?
So far, not really.
Not really?
I think the biggest pet peeve I have with not just crime fiction or whatever it is when things get too convenient. You have this problem where everybody's stuck and suddenly a magical rabbit appears and solves everything. I think that's the pet peeve of not just myself, but many of the other writers that who I work with. Yeah.
Okay, I was just wondering, apart from yourself, could you perhaps name three, and I'm putting you on the spot here because you've been on a long flight, haven't gone to sleep yet, but apart from yourself, could you name say three Singaporean writers who you think would be wonderful for people to discover?
Okay, actually the first name that came to me was Mina Poon. She's quite known, actually. She was longlisted for Man Booker.
Okay.
But we always find that, you know, she could do with more publicity. Joyce Cheng, she writes, the reason why I like what she writes is because she has that great balance of Singaporean culture that doesn't get stuffed down your throat, and the very fantastical elements that can be quite believable. You know, you can imagine things, you can think of alternative situations or universes. I think the last okay, I'm going to be a bit thick-skinned here and say that the last hidden gem is the Happy Smiley Writers Group, mostly because I am from it. But I think there's a lot of potential within the writers in that group. You have people who write romance, you have people who write science fiction, you have people who write young adult. And it's because we write so many different genres that it becomes very interesting. And, you know, you bounce ideas off each other, you get feedback. So I guess at the end of the day, like one of the books that I've given to the Writer Center and yourself, Bubblegum, in the end something like that comes up and people do like it. I think it's not just how the story plays out, but I think it's sort of the mishmash of all the styles that you can see. That being said, I do have a few Malaysian people I would like to give a shout out to as well.
Go for it.
Graphic novelists in both Singapore and Malaysia have been on the rise as well. One such person is Chi Ming Boy. He's actually a Malaysian. I think he's based in US now, I'm not very sure. But he drew a biographical comic called When I Was a Kid. It's on to his fourth reprint now, and I think it's very popular, especially amongst Malaysians and Singaporeans, because it's something that we can relate to without it being too sappy or too cultural. It's very real, it's very short, and the way he writes is very frank. So, in a sense, he tells stories the way we would do it as well, and that's what makes it very funny. So, yeah, that's Boyi. Dave Chua, he's not really a graphic novelist. He writes, he just wrote a few, I think he just collaborated with another artist on a graphic novel that he's going to come up with. He writes in a very, it's very relatable as well, but it's in a more poignant way. You don't feel that it's too much. It gives you the essence of identity and life as you see it. And he's a very visual writer, so you can actually picture that. And I think that's why some of his books, like Gone Case, one of his older works, got to get produced as a graphic novel, two-part graphic novel, which is actually quite popular. Okay, the last person I want to give a shout out to is one of my friends, Max Lowe. I wouldn't say he's there yet. He is emerging mostly because we like his art. It's very funny. It's like Bowie's work, but in a very honest, frank way, and it's very genuine. So, yeah, that's the gems that we are looking out for. It's not just the writers, the graphic novelists as well, mostly because we think it's a good way to get people to start. Yeah.
Okay. I'll provide in the show notes links to each of those people.
I think I'll just email you some of the links as well.
No worries. And for anyone that we missed out there, don't worry. Mm-hmm. I'll have some extra information from Geraldine about who else we should be following and looking out for. You were recently published in the I Am Curtain anthology that was launched at the Singapore Writers Festival. And what was that launch experience like, a speculative fiction book launched at a major literary festival?
It was actually very interesting. First thing to note was that it was raining like crazy that day, and we still had Full House. It was also together with two other anthologies by the same publisher. And it was very, it was quite interesting because it's a very different kind of anthology. We were launched together with two other books, Balik Kampung, and which means go home in Malay, and Fish Eats Lion, both of which talk about things like Fish Eats Lion talks about SFF, science fiction fantasy, in Singapore, in a Singaporean situation. And Balik Kampung talks about how different neighborhoods in Singapore have changed through the eyes of people who have lived there for a while. So these stories are full-length stories, like full-length short stories. Whereas for I Am Curtain, it's this whole collection of very short, sharp pieces on alternate Singapore. So it's three very different subject matters in the same session. And it's very interesting that most of the writers actually overlap. And it's very, and it, for me, it struck as a very wonderful experience, because you can see the versatility of, you can see how versatile these people are, and you can see that people actually do support such works, because not just this launch, I think we had another, I Am Curtain had another soft launch the week after at Books Actually itself, and it was quite full. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
I asked the question originally because when I think I might have been talking to you about 6 months ago, and you were thinking of coming down for the Adelaide Writers Festival.
Uh-huh.
The queen of the festival was Margot Lanigan, who's a well-known speculative fiction writer in Australia, and that to me sort of was interesting that the festival would put one of ours up there, if you get what I'm saying, one of the our community, genre community, and have them as the leading or opening up the festival. So it's, and she obviously did talks about her book as well, and I thought it was interesting that Singapore had the same sort of thing, as genre starting to creep into what would probably be considered more literary festivals. And then we can have arguments of whether or not literature is a genre just as much as all the other
I think
ones.
We have those kinds of arguments as much as anyone else.
No worries. Getting close to the end, and I'm very conscious of the fact that you probably want to just go on lie down and go to sleep. So this will be the last question. Is there any cringe factor associated with perhaps writing a story about things that are particular to Singapore in science fiction? Do you go, oh, that just sounds a bit wrong to my ear? That's what I'm getting at.
I think at the end of the day, it's about what the author wants to write. Some of us are still not very comfortable. Some still draw a lot of influence from other works. I think for myself, it's about striking that balance and feeling comfortable with what you write at the end of the day. So it's not really just about the cringe factor, or, as you say, like speaking as a Singaporean voice in a certain genre. It's not just about that. I think it's also about making sure that you're comfortable with telling the story. I was telling one of my friends, Joyce, I do have this policy that I do not write what I cannot say. And I think it's very important, because if you find that what you put out there makes you feel uncomfortable, then it's something that either has to be changed, or you have to kind of look at it in a very different perspective, I guess. Because at the end of the day, if you're not comfortable with your work, then how are you going to be comfortable putting it out? That's the main thing, I guess.
Sounds like a good answer.
Yeah.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
And thanks for the opportunity. You're on Twitter under the handle at Jolynn Alexandra, all one word?
Yes.
Yep. And you also blog at jolynnalexandra.wordpress.com?
Yes.
And I'll put that in the show notes, because nobody's going to be able to remember that off the top of their head.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Hi, listeners. This is Colin Tabor, dark fantasy author of The Fall of Asard and Asard's Hope, and you're listening to The Adventures of a Booknaut, where Sean is unearthing great emerging talent, and fantastic new genre reads.
And welcome back. In this segment, I'm talking with academic and member of the Secret Feminist Cabal, Dr. Helen Merrick. Welcome to the podcast, Helen.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you for having me.
Now, I've just finished reading your book, The Secret Feminist Cabal, which was published by Aqueduct Press in around 2009. It was certainly eye-opening or consciousness-raising for me. Can you tell our listeners what your intention with the book was?
This book had a really, really long genesis. So it actually started life as my PhD thesis, so back in the mid to late 90s. So my intention then and my intention with the book later were different things, I guess. But both of them were motivated by my love for science fiction and the fact that when I went to university in the 90s and started doing feminist theory and women's history, I kind of was gathering all this critical understanding and perspective, which I then turned upon my favourite genre and cringed. So I started a quest, I guess, to find the women and the feminists in science fiction. And as I say in the book originally, it was a lightning strike moment for me when I read theorist Donna Haraway's work in The Manifesto for Cyborgs, because she talked about this thing called feminist science fiction, which I had never heard of before. So she started my quest, I guess. She gave sources in there. She talked about books like Joanna Russ and Samuel Delaney and Vonda McIntyre. So I went and looked them all up, and then I started reading everything I could about feminism and women in science fiction. And I was looking for the works of fiction as well as critical works. And what was fascinating to me is that I kept having to go further and further back. So originally thinking that this, you know, started in the 60s and 70s with the women's movement, it became increasingly clear that women had a far longer history in science fiction. But what the real impetus by the end of the book was for me as well was I was totally bemused by the fact that so many of my other kind of feminist friends and academics and researchers were still kind of, I don't know, appalled about what I was researching. And so the general reaction would be, why are you looking at this boys thing? Surely there can't be any feminism in there. So in fact, for me, the project became one of demonstrating how intense and exciting and liberating and innovative the feminist work within science fiction had been. So it became one enormous argument to try and hit other feminists over the head and say, hey, there's this whole genre, this whole area of feminist cultural work that you are missing out on because you refuse to look at this boys' own genre.
Okay, that's interesting, because I was just thinking as you were answering then, my feelings about the book, there's certainly an appeal there to people within genre to take a deeper investigation of the genre itself and find out, you know, a more accurate history. And then there's almost like you've just mentioned there, an appeal to I suppose, is it literary sort of fiction, to say, look, or literary fiction feminism, if that's even exists, to come and say, well, look, you know, this is, you know, we've got within the genre, we've got you know, a resistance against feminism, and then you've almost got a resistance from outside believing that that the genre could be feminist. So no, that was interesting. Probably the clearest point that struck me when I was reading, and this is most likely because I've got a history background, it was the history and the very significant contribution that you mentioned from women from the very beginning of the SF genre. And you've sort of answered my question in that last answer about being a revelation for yourself. Mm. So your perceptions before doing the research was what? In regards to women in SF or feminism in SF.
Yeah, I was very much like you, I think, and also like you, my background is in history, so I'm a historian originally, so it's not surprising that there's a lot of historical work in the book. I've grown up reading science fiction, but I read the boys. I read Asimov and Clarke and Heinlein, and as I say, it wasn't really till the 90s that I discovered feminist science fiction. I then realized that I probably actually had read a lot more women when I was younger, but it just didn't click. I mean, I had read Andre Norton, I had read Anne McCaffrey, all these things, but they didn't, I don't know, I just somehow managed to blank it out. In fact, this is what Connie Willis talks about in that old article of hers, you know, the women SF doesn't see. Anyway, as I started to do my research, I was also in contact with a couple of other people, one of whom was Justine Labalestia, who is now, of course, a very well-known young adult author. And she was doing a PhD at the time as well. And it was her, actually, who alerted me to the fact that women had a much longer presence in science fiction, because the research she was doing was looking at the a lot of the fanzines from the 50s and before, and uncovering kind of this evidence for women's experience and presence in the genre. So that just spurred me on, and and because I'm a historian and I love doing archival research, that was it. I tried to chase up every, you know, magazine, column, fanzine I could to reveal the evidence of women's experience in the genre. Then there's also another whole area of experience that is kind of outside the genre, but it's important for our thinking historically, which was even in the late 19th century, so before the genre really, you know, came to be cohered within the pulp magazines. So just as within the more mainstream science fiction literary canon, people would look to Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, for example, there was a whole slew of women writers in the late 19th century who were writing effectively kind of pre-feminist utopias, so doing a similar thing. They weren't exactly writing science fiction, but they were writing people who traveled to other times and cultures, and it's a really strong tradition of feminist utopian writing, which certainly is important. It's an important antecedent for a lot of the work that came later.
Okay, I might have to chase you up afterwards for some of those authors. Since I think I was reading Atwood's latest non-fiction book, which the name escapes me at the moment.
I haven't read it yet, but yes.
And she really sort of twigged me on to some of the earlier writings. I mean, I've heard of Verne and Wells, of course, but so there were some other areas I think that she was researching for a PhD years ago, and it sort of made me think, oh, that sounds really interesting. I need it at some stage when my, you know, I've crawled out of my to-be-read piles, I'll be able to hunt that down.
There's some really good stuff there, and I'll put in a couple of cells now. One of my absolute favourites is fascinating, because it's also written by an Indian woman, a Bengali woman, at the very turn of the century. I think it's 1907, and it's called The Sultana's Dream. And it's just astonishing. So I'll probably get the pronunciation wrong, but it's written in 1905 by Rokeya Sakhawat Hussain, so a Muslim feminist in 1905. And so The Sultana's Dream is just awesome. It's basically the women kind of get together from out of the harem and go, men are ruining society. They're just getting everything wrong. We really need to take over. So they take over and they develop this beautiful utopian society, mostly based on technology. They have kind of, you know, early examples of like solar and wind power, and they're incredibly erudite, and they talk about, you know, science and mathematics. And it's just the most awesome statement, I guess, of women's intelligence and equal participation. And yeah, it's fantastic. And it's available online. It's quite short. It's effectively a short story, a novella. So that's really worth looking up, just to blow your mind in terms of thinking of, you know, women writing this kind of feminist utopia that is based on science and technology, you know, right back then. So plenty of examples.
Oh, I'm getting the feeling this might be an expensive podcast. I'm going to have to go and buy some books.
A lot of them are available online through, you know, the Gutenberg and stuff. So a lot of this 19th century material you can actually get online for free, legitimately. There's a few Australian examples too. So, yes, it shouldn't be too expensive. It might be very time consuming, though.
Okay, then. I'm lucky then. As we've talked, my faulty perception was that significant involvement of women in the genre began much later, but admittedly, I'm a bit of a newcomer to community fandom. I've lived rurally or remotely most of my life, so my experience of science fiction is ABC, Doctor Who, the Target printings of the books and that sort of thing. So that was my introduction So yeah, there appears to be, and this is just my perception after having read your book, but there appears to be a generational forgetting or a collective amnesia experienced by the genre, and by that I mean the people involved in the genre, writers and readers, about the involvement of women. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on why you think that we, the science fiction and fantasy community, have this tendency, or is it in fact a tendency that's just particular to us, this forgetting of women's involvement, excuse me.
Yeah, it's not particular to us at all. It's very, very common. I did find it particularly interesting when I was researching the science fiction history, that it literally is a cycle that seemed to occur every 15 years. So going right back to the beginning, when you see the first exchanges between readers in the letter columns of the pulp magazines. So by the 30s, you will have the occasional woman popping up and going, "Hey guys, I read science fiction too, and it's really cool." And male readers and editors going, "Oh my goodness, there's a woman." And then it kind of dies down. They have a big fuss about it and dies down. And then, you know, 10, 15 years later, it's the 50s and, you know, new editors are going, "Oh, we're getting all these letters from women. Isn't this amazing?" You know, so it does seem to keep happening. Then, of course, you hit the late 60s and you have that big turnaround that, even though it'll be dampened a little bit, we've never been able to shut the women up since then. I don't think you can, you know, totally deny the existence of women in science fiction since then. But, I mean, it was fascinating. And there's interesting stories about a particular science fiction author, Isaac Asimov, who was making a fuss about women in the genre back when he was a 17-year-old writing into the pulps. And then he changed his tune a bit, but in the 70s, early 70s, he was basically talking about the ways in which women were invading the genre and coming in through Star Trek fandom, and how this was a big shock. And so that goes into all kinds of other interesting ideas about the ways in which we protect our boundaries. So a lot of that was actually about the resistance of the more literary science fiction fandom and community against what they saw as, I think he actually called it, the invasion of the hordes, you know, the media hordes, media science fiction. Whoa. So it's, you know, sometimes media fans had worse cooties than women at times in the history. but yeah, so there is definitely this forgetting, and it does happen, and it's hard to say why it particularly happens in this community. I mean, a lot of it was because the women who were writing for the early pulps often were using gender-neutral names or names with initials, and some of them, you know, of course, stayed well-known, like C.L. Moore and Andre Norton, and others didn't. But one of the real problems, I think, was particularly when we're looking at the early periods of the genre and then moving into the 50s and 60s, where we see science fiction increasingly being communicated through books rather than through the magazines and short stories. What you have is a whole generations of women who mainly wrote short stories. And if they didn't have novels that could be published by the science fiction book clubs and circulated that way, it was really easy for their work to slip through the cracks and disappear. So you had a lot of that happening in the early 70s feminist fanzines, when they were talking about trying to reclaim women writers, you know, sort of making it clear that sometimes it was just really, really hard to source their work. And if their short fiction hadn't been collected, it was really easy to forget them. It was really easy for their work to disappear. So unless you're a collector who had, you know, the last 30 years worth of you know, amazing stories, it was very easy for that work to disappear. But so I guess one of the particular difficulties with science fiction was its pulp history, was the fact that a lot of its work was published in publications that easily disappeared or deteriorated. But certainly this is not unique, and you see it in you know, literary fiction when you look at and again, it was the 60s and 70s when women and feminist critics started rediscovering female work in their own area, whether it be literature, whether it be history, that you have this great uncovering of previous generations of women writing. And certainly years ago, Dale Spender talked about this, you know, the way that it's so easy for us to lose women's history to lose, what she calls her story, that there is this sort of cyclic forgetting. So, you know, there was a huge bloom of obviously of women's writing and politics in the late 19th century with, you know, the movement to suffrage. And a lot of that work and women and has been forgotten and got rediscovered in the 60s and 70s. And in some ways, I think is being forgotten now. And in many ways, a lot of the radical work from the 60s and 70s is being forgotten today by younger generations. So, you know, unless this work gets canonized and becomes the focus of reprinting and becomes the focus for university courses or school reading, then, you know, it's easy to slip through, especially as we're seeing such shifts in publishing. I should stop talking now, sorry.
No, that's all right.
I get very passionate about this.
I can tell, it's great. No, there was an article I read this morning by Elizabeth Luetti, who's the I suppose the main instigator behind the Australian Women Writers Challenge that I've been participating in this year, and they did a short article on the breakdown of the book shows, the ABC's book shows, 50 greatest books by Australian authors, and they did a nice little breakdown, and I think about 30% were women, and this is just off the top of my head, 30% of those books, those top 50 were women, and 10% of those women were alive. So there was this, even in, I suppose, in literature, you've got this predominance of male writers being sort of reinforced, and they were all, from memory, pretty canonical books too. So you're thinking, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head, but it's I've lost it now, so I can't remember the books. But yeah, very, very few of them, and I don't think, unless you count Picnic at Hanging Rock, were sort of speculative fiction. So despite there being, you know, works out there that would certainly fall under that. Your book is about SF feminisms, plural. It covers not only writers but fan participation. One particular quote that I picked out from Henry Ernst in 1953 regards, in regards to female fans, he said that there were three types of femme fans, and even the best could only be secondary or fake fans. And this immediately brought to mind the comments made a couple of weeks ago by comic book artist Tony Harris and his fake geek girl slur. You may have answered it in previous questions, but why do you think we still see this sort of really harsh reaction to women and their participation in fandom?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. Looking back to the kinds of reactions that were happening, say, from the 30s to the 50s in science fiction fandom, it's, you know, I'm not saying it's excusable, but it's a lot more understandable because science fiction was really seen as such a men's domain, and because it was very focused on, I guess, kind of engineering, you know. And so there was this sense, literally, that there was nothing in there that women could be interested in. So even though, you know, it was ridiculous because, of course, we'd had women working in science and engineering, you know, for a very long time, there was still this perception that it was very much a man's world and that there was nothing in there to interest women, and that, you know, I think that, you know, they even stated that, you know, basically there is no love or sex interest in science fiction, therefore women will not be interested in it because that's their only entree into a story, obviously. Today I find it harder to understand. I mean, I'm kind of annoyed at you, Sean, because you made me go and look at the comments. I'd seen all this when it came up a few weeks ago. I went, oh, God. And left it alone. And looking at the comments, and it takes, I guess it's, you know, part of this forgetting and part of this cycle. Part of it, I think, is that you get generations of women or whoever are agitating or standing up for a certain group. And after 10 years or 15 years of doing it, you get really tired and you've had enough and you can't go there again. So you need to wait for the next generation to come up and get their gloves on and start fighting. It's about power and protecting people's own little hearth and not wanting to feel uncomfortable. So some of the comments I was reading in there is about people's sense of entitlement, I guess, and how they become angry when it seems that their historical kind of entitlements are going to be disrupted or not met, or that their underlying assumptions about their entitlements are being exposed and brought to the fore and challenged. And I think in some ways, I think the Tony Harris actually isn't so much about the who's in and who's out of our community as just straight kind of pretty nasty sexism about him not having certain expectations met, and that using this notion of, you know, who has a right to be here as a way of attack. So a lot of this who's in and who's out of our community is a way of protecting the place where you feel comfortable, and increasingly, you know, various minorities, you know, women, people of other sexualities, people of different races and colour are demanding entry into communities where people have been allowed to be safe and they're prejudiced for a long time, and it's really uncomfortable. It always reminds me, I think it's Ursula Le Guin once, who talked about some of the tensions that arise when people used to get really upset if, you know, the early days women wanted to go off together and kind of have safe spaces to talk about feminist issues or whatever, and that people would get really upset about this and say, oh, but that's separatist, that's terrible, how can you save the world, or how can you change things if you're going to go off and do this separatist thing? She said, well, no one makes a fuss about Senate, you know, and that's like totally all male, you know, that there are, we're used to having institutions where there are all male bastions and no one, and all white all male bastions, and that's normalized for us. As soon as those expectations start getting challenged, people get upset. Yeah, but we seem to be doing a pretty good job actually of upsetting people, and so I think that's a good thing. It's hard to work through, and it's hard to deal with, and it's really hard to be some of the people who are at the forefront of pointing these things out all the time. But as one of the links you sent me, I think the game community discussion of it point out, you know, we're kind of winning because these discussions are happening more and more often. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, I'm afraid now that I might anger you again with the next question, because it refers to an article that I sent you to read. I read Tansy Rayner Roberts' Tor article. It was posted on her site, and then it was, I think, so popular that somebody said put it on Tor. It's called Historically Authentic Sexism in Fantasy. Let's Unpack That. And for me, aside from being a really good explanation of the realities of the construction of history, the comments section inspired some thought about male participation in bringing feminist, or at least women's SF history to light. And I wanted to ask you, what role do you think male readers, writers, and fans have in ensuring that we don't suffer that collective amnesia?
Oh, a huge role, and I'm really glad you brought it up. But again, yeah, not so happy I had to look at the comments, with some of which leave me speechless, not in a really ranty, angry way that often comments can, but literally in that speechless sense where you go, There is so big a distance between what we are trying to talk about here and what message is being received at the other end that you sometimes wonder how you can possibly explain. I think that male readers and writers and bloggers and reviewers like yourself have a really important role to play. And this makes me really sad, but I think it's true that some messages will not be heard by some men unless they are spoken by men. Which pains me, you know, but I think there is this automatic blinder that comes down sometimes when we talk about sexism and gender roles, where it's like, well, we're just trying to, elevate ourselves. And you see this response to the article by Tansy from some of the male readers, whereas if male readers can talk about similar issues, but from their own point of view, that this might be easier to be heard. I found it really interesting that one of the, what I see as a misreading of Tansy's article was this notion that what she was trying to argue was that the current understanding of, you know, scare quotes, gender roles, is just a particular angle, and that, you know, Tansy and we are asking writers to take this particular angle when you look at fiction. So totally misunderstanding the underlying argument, which is that no matter what you think went on in history, no matter what history books you read, no matter what you like in fantasy, men and women are both people. we need to see ourselves reflected in history and in fiction as people. If you have a problem with this, then maybe you actually need to be looking at what it is you want out of life and out of your fiction and out of your history. So we're not saying, and it's this argument that comes up, we're not saying you have to take a totally revisionist approach that goes, oh, back in the Middle Ages, everything was fantastic and wonderful. And, you know, no. But the point that Tansy makes is really interesting and really vital, which is that all of our understandings of the past are brought to us through a very particular lens. So, you know, it's a very male-dominated lens. It's also, for those of us in, you know, Western countries, an incredibly colonialist and white lens. And so if you want to have, I guess, a deeper understanding of you know, humanity and people's relationships, then you can't just keep, I don't know, pretending that it that this stuff hasn't happened, or pretending that we haven't come to better understandings of humanity. I mean, do people really want to go back to a time when we thought it was okay to treat certain people and certain groups of people as if they were no better than, you know, flora and fauna? Well, you know, no, hopefully. Yeah. And the thing is, you know, again, with fantasy fiction, I think there's a particular comment which totally blew my mind, where this notion that most readers of science fiction and fantasy are men. Most men will want to read about men, and because you will associate better with a male character, and so therefore it makes economic sense for men to write pretty much all the genre and to write about men. And of course, the big blind spot here is that, well, what do you think women and people of colour and gay people have been doing for years? How have we survived when we haven't had any of our people to read about? No, we get used to actually having to relate to mostly white males as point of view characters. And what this does is it gives us a much broader understanding of how society works. You know, that notion that the oppressors will always have less understanding of the other culture because they never have to deal with it or associate with it. Whereas if you are the part of society that is being oppressed, you have to understand the master's culture, otherwise you do not survive. So, yeah, anyway. how do you get that point across? I don't know, because it's really hard to get across, and it feels like you could have 100 people standing in the room yelling this point and that people still wouldn't get it, that you are only reading from one side of a huge spectrum if you think that the only way that you can actually enter a story or enjoy anything is to have it represented through a point of view position that is exactly the same as yours. It's sad, really. It's sad. It's startling.
I'm glad I didn't send you the Foz Meadows link, because that was a reaction to the claim that Tansy's article, I think, was just advancing one sort of agenda, and she goes on to point out, well, isn't the status quo advancing, you know, the agenda of a very sort of limited minority, that being white male sort of middle class? So I won't direct that to you, because you probably don't have time.
I don't have much time, but also I was really tempted, and I think I might have to do it if nobody else does, because the very last comment not only incenses me for all those other reasons, but also because he addresses Tansy as Mrs. Roberts. Doesn't that say a lot? Mrs. Roberts. One, how does she know? You know, she's a missus. And two, I just felt like I just want to put anything that goes, excuse me, that is Dr. Rainer Roberts. Thank you very much. Good night.
I didn't pick that up. I should go back and have a look.
Anyway. On.
All right. Following on from that rather interesting discussion, I was wondering if you could recommend one or two books aside from your own, of course. For those interested in discovering the contribution of women to the genre, what would they be, your top two favourites?
Oh, I can't do two. Can I have some non-fiction and some fiction?
You can have whatever you want. That's fine with me. Fire away.
So for the fiction, because I think you need to go and read the fiction. It's not enough to just to read critical work. Pamela Sargent has been doing the most astonishing work in terms of collections for donkey's years. So she did the very first collections in the early 70s that brought together some really important women's work. And this is the Women of Wonder series. There was three of them. I have the originals. I have no idea how hard they are to get hold of anymore. If you can get them in libraries, do look them up. So it's Women of Wonder, More Women of Wonder, and New Women of Wonder, I think, all published within about 5 years in the early 70s. And then, fantastically, because they were hard to get hold of, in the 90s, I think, she did two more mega collections, which is Women of Wonder, the classic years, and Women of Wonder, I think, the contemporary years. Now, between those books, you will get a fantastic overview of the kinds of contribution women writers have made to the genre over quite a long period of time. And there are other collections, but they're incredibly representative. And also, Sargent was really crucial because she also wrote these amazing introductions, which were, I think, some of the first examples of kind of a woman's history of science fiction and you know, a feminist approach to science fiction history. So they are vital. They're really worth looking up. There's also another collection, and I'll now forget who it is, called New Eves. I think I saw someone talking about it on Twitter recently, actually. Again, another fantastic collection of some early women's science fiction. In terms of critical stuff, I think the work that Justine Lavalesia did for her PhD, which then became a book, The Battle of the Sexes in Science Fiction, is also really crucial for looking at what was going on in those early years, so the 50s and 60s and 70s. So she riffs off Joanna Russ's work. Joanna Russ was the first one to come up with that term, The Battle of the Sexes in Science Fiction. So that's a great book for understanding. And she talks about a lot of the same material in terms of the fanzines in the 50s and so on. Justine also edited a great collection called Daughters of Earth, where she pairs up an example of a science fiction author with a critic talking about their work. And she tries to get a historical spread in there. And then, I mean, there are older books. There are lots of fantastic works about feminist science fiction, but I guess among the more recent, I would say Lisa Yazcek, if I'm pronouncing her name right, I never know, Galactic Suburbia, which of course is where our friends Galactic Suburbia podcast got their title on, which comes from a Joanna Russ article as well. But that's talking more about the kind of the 50s and 60s. Yeah, so there's plenty of material out there.
Moving on to the last question. You teach or have taught cyberculture, women's studies and history, and your bio at Curtin University lists an interest in online culture. Now, I'm interested in your opinion on how the internet may have disrupted the power of gatekeepers within the community and whether this bodes well for SF feminisms. And referring back to your book here, I'm thinking in particular of Jean Gommel quote or a criticism of Bruce Sterling and his foreword in Burning Chrome, and where she said of that particular book, with a touch of the keys on his word processor, Sterling dumps a decade of SF writing out of critical memory. The whole decade was boring, symptomatic of a sick culture, not worth talking about. Now at last, he says, we're on to the right stuff again. So I'm just wondering, yeah, back to the question about gatekeepers, what do you think, I suppose, the current situation bodes for SF feminisms?
I think with some caution, I think it's healthier. I think it is more positive. I think it provides various groups, I guess, in this case, looking particularly at women, women and feminists from different backgrounds to have an easier sense of communication and community than was possible when we were limited to our geographic areas and snail mail. So certainly when you look back at the history of women's fandom, you know, women tried really, really hard to get in touch with each other, but sometimes it was really difficult. When you look at the early days of Australian fandom in the 50s, for example, you know, you're talking about a handful of women, the same in the UK, you know, there would be these handfuls, but it was hard to stay in touch. So I think it has made it much easier for us to find, you know, our tribe, to find the people to talk to, where you can have your sanity spaces, where you can have conversations with like-minded people that make you think that you're not crazy. So I think that's incredibly positive. And I think that the internet also has a really crucial role to play in terms of providing spaces for I guess, repositories and archives that can help maintain our history and maintain records of these connections. I guess the danger is because there is so much out there, because there is so much, you know, noise ratio, because it can be really difficult to find the valuable curated information, that there is the fear that we will just be swamped, you know, by nonsense, and then, you know, swamped by the comments and not find the gems. And so a lot of it is about community. It's about, if we establish the community, who can then kind of, I guess, have an editorial present, curate the knowledge, then that is crucial. There is also the sense that having a greater visibility also means that you are more vulnerable to attack, and that we do have to keep having some of these ridiculous conversations that can be very challenging and even, you know, painful and hateful, that we do have to work out strategies to deal with the ways in which women in particular and people of colour and people of different sexualities very easily come under attack if they put their head above the precipice and start talking about these issues. So again, it comes down to community. Having a community that will nurture you and support you and defend you is really, really crucial. So thinking about the book and my experiences over the last 10 or 20 years, I mean, I went from having a certain level of support amongst local fandom in Perth, for example, where I'd have people to talk to, but I got tired of doing the Feminism 101 for a long time, and so I would still go along to our cons, but I became a bit dissociated. Then in the late 90s, I got involved with some of the electronic, the old days, good old email list. So one called, which is still going, called FemSF, which is a discussion of feminist SF, which was a revelation and was, you know, a link, this really close link to a community. And I found that essentially through going to WISCOM. And then over the decades, it's become easier to find people. And I've been really buoyed by the fact that you have a press like Aqueduct emerging, for example. And that really would not have been possible without the ways that the internet developed, you know, after sort of 1998. I mean, I remember discussions about book publishing and feminism and science fiction in the late 90s, and it was all quite depressed and depressing. There was a lot of talk about print on demand and what might happen, but the internet hadn't quite taken off and become this massive, you know, public presence at that point. So there really wasn't an expectation that we could have this quite radical revolution in publishing that would also be really crucial to establishing these kinds of communities. So when I think about Aqueduct Press and some of the other independent presses that have now, because of ebooks and because of electronic distribution and because of being able to have an online shopfront, have suddenly been able to put out all this material, that becomes a nexus or focus point for fandoms and for criticisms, and it draws people together in ways that I don't think were possible before. So it's just, I think it's astounding to see some of the fantastic feminist work and work by people of colour and queer science fiction that have been published, you know, over the last few years. So while we're freaking out about what's happening to publishing, there is still work out there that wouldn't have existed before. And it's become a conversation point for us. And then on top of that, you see communities building. I mean, I really like what Tor are doing, for example, the ways they're bringing in people like Britt Mandello and Tansy Rona Roberts. And, you know, they're establishing some focus points to talk about much more diverse issues. It's really exciting. The podcast, you know, the Galactic Suburba and the Writer and the Critic and you know, all these really exciting ventures, Julia Rios, Outer Alliance. You know, there are some incredibly positive aspects, I think, to the communities and conversations we're having online. And certainly I credit some of the younger women in Perth fandom for getting me active and involved again, and it was through them that I met, you know, people like Elisa, and through her that I met Tansy. So it's reconnected me in a global way that I'd started backing down. I'd buried myself in academia, really. So they revitalized me, and that wouldn't have been possible without some of these connections that we had made. So yes, there are issues, there are problems. We need to be cautious and careful. But yes, on the whole, I think it is incredibly positive if we use it the right way.
No, I could literally listen to you talk all day about this, but I'm very very conscious of the fact that you're quite busy. So I'd like to say it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, Helen, and thank you for the opportunity and the time, and I'd like to wish you a Merry Christmas.
Oh, thank you very much, Sean. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for reading my book, and I hope you have a wonderful Christmas and New Year.
And that brings us, dear listeners, to the end of the podcast. Thank you for listening. You may leave audio feedback at www.speakpipe.com/bookanaut. Check the show notes for a link. Or you may leave written feedback on Facebook, the Podomatic page, or at my blog.